Well, I welcome you all back to the session on resilience, building resilience of agroecosystems. And one of the good things about organizing these symposia is you get to invite yourself to speak. So I went ahead and did that. So you can blame me for my presentation from the standpoint of being here this afternoon. And the title that I'm given is Building Soil Resilience for an Uncertain Future. And from my own standpoint, I'm a soil scientist with USDA ARS, but I also wear another hat. I have also been, for the last 15 years, a supervisor at the Lake Tahoe and Water Conservation District. So that's an elected position, and the board is composed of primarily growers and other producers that are basically trying to look at the wise use of resources in their counties. And they kind of serve as an on-the-ground presence from the standpoint of identifying what those resource issues are, prioritizing those, and moving forward with the standpoint of district activities. I'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later in my talk, but I thought I'd mention it right off. Soil, as many of you know, is either directly or indirectly responsible for about 95% of our food. And it also houses about a quarter of our biodiversity on the planet. And if you're going to understand ecosystem services, you're going to have to know something about understanding soils as well. And every soil has a story. Everyone is unique. And from that standpoint, if you look at the number of soil series in the United States, I think it's around 23,000, maybe that's the world, 23,000. And each of those soils responds differently to various kinds of stresses and stressors. And that response then is reflected in the soil properties and processes that you'll see. So that story, if you're trained to read the story, you know, is written out there on the land. You can see the thin dark line here that I'm showing. And John Kierkegaard mentioned, well, in Australia, we don't even have a thin dark line. But of course, this is where much of the nutrition is from the standpoint of the organic matter, the storehouse of nutrients. You can see that particular soil has a very distinct AP boundary there with the plow turned those soils over since the advent almost of agriculture about 100 years ago in this part of the world. The soil is located at the Cook Agronomy Farm, which is in eastern Washington. It's a place where I do quite a bit of research. It's, you know, those soils are the star of our show, but you can see from the standpoint, or maybe you can't, right underneath that plow there is a accumulation of calcium carbonate. This is a BK horizon. And that horizon used to be much deeper in the subsoil. And the reason you're seeing this distinct boundary besides the AP horizon from the plowing is that we're actually missing a whole horizon that used to be there. There used to be a cambic horizon, a BW horizon that was between this A horizon that's there and this lighter material that's below. But through the turning action of the plow, through erosional processes from the standpoint of tillage and water erosion, we've gradually just mixed that whole layer, and it's now missing completely from the soil profile. So this degradation is something that people call sometimes a quiet crisis, because there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of public awareness about some of the kinds of degradation that are going on with soils. And we can go through a list. Soil erosion is one that's still fairly prevalent around the country. Declining soil organic matter kind of accompanies some of that. Soil acidification, low soil biological activity, diversity, salinization, water logging, nutrient depletion, compaction, surface crusting. If you look around the world, this is a recent report by Stahl and Lau that looks at land degradation, recognizing that land is not just soil, but it's also vegetation and water. But you can see for severe and very severe percentages in different regions, we're looking at about a quarter or more from the standpoint of total degraded lands. So from that standpoint, this is an issue that takes place and occurs around the world. And it's driven mostly by human action from the standpoint of agricultural lands. It represents depletion of natural capital, diminished capacity to generate ecosystem services, loss of agri-ecosystem resilience. And from my point of view, it represents a failure of our adaptive capacity, our ability to manage resilience in the face of system stresses, uncertainties, and surprises. I was, you know, thinking about this talk, and, you know, it seems like there's this paradox. Here you have degradation and depletion of natural capital that continues, and at the same time, we're at the height of our knowledge and technological skills. Why is that? And many people have placed agriculture at a crossroads, the need for transformation. What can we do? Can we create an agriculture with social ecological resilience to cope with future changes and uncertainties? And I was recently reading this this book by DeGraff and Batker. It's called What's the Economy For Anyway? And they talk about different world views. So I'll apologize to the economists like Vicky that I see out there. But here, some people's view is here we have this economy and housed within this is the world with the natural capital that's there. And we kind of extract that. And their point of view that they were trying to promote was, oh my gosh, this has flipped around. We need the economy to be embedded in the natural capital. And they had a simple test that they gave their audiences when they were talking about this. And they said, well, hold your breath. And if you can do that for 5 minutes, then perhaps the economy is more worthwhile than the natural capital. So everyone hold their breath for 5 minutes. Does anybody do that? Okay. All that natural capital is around it. We take it for granted sometimes. But from that standpoint, without it, we're gone. So future changes and uncertainties really identify what our challenges are. And this is my soil science perspective, of course, but all of you that took soil science can probably remember their introductory soils class. There were 5 soil-forming factors. Included in those were climate, organisms, topography, parent material acting over time to give us different kinds of soil properties. And certainly, though, climate and organisms were huge drivers from the standpoint of influencing different kinds of soil properties and processes. And back then, we used to think, well, climate, back when I took soil, sorry, that was back in the last century, climate was thought to be rather static from the standpoint of moving forward. We say, well, this is going to be what we're getting, you know, from that standpoint. But now, of course, that's all changed. And what you see in this diagram is just for the northern latitudes around the Pacific Northwest, some projections of temperature on into 2100, RCP 8.5 representative conservation pathways, and my gosh, temperature is projected to go up. And from that standpoint, though, you can also see the uncertainty around that, the dispersion around those projections. And so from that standpoint and from the standpoint of the PLUS, we're wondering about the role that drought and heat stress might play later on as the century evolves. And as other people have mentioned, there's also human action from the standpoint of what's occurring, from the standpoint of our societies, only the economy, the policies that we have that also introduce quite a bit of uncertainty, as it's also been mentioned. And when I talk to farmers, you know, I know some that will look at some of our government programs and almost throw up their hands because of the complexity and move on and not participate at times. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit for a second and then go on to something else. But how many of you are familiar with the cropland data layer that have looked at it from NASS? Okay, this is a 30-meter resolution of pixels across the nation that show, from an agricultural standpoint, what a farmer or a landowner or a land manager chose to put on that ground. So here is classified whether it was in wheat or peas in our relationship or whether it was in corn or soybeans or anything else. And it's really the consequence, it emerged as a consequence of all the biophysical and social economic drivers that led to that decision to put this particular crop in that particular place in this field. So here you have an expression then of the decisions that landowners and land managers have made from the standpoint of what to grow. And it happens every year. We can get these data every year. So starting from 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, we have this record that's accumulating from the standpoint of what was the land use and cover. And from that, you can start to devise, okay, what's the dynamic over time in terms of changes that might occur given these kinds of data? And you can also go through a process like we've gone through to not only look at the crops that are grown there, but to also identify, well, what cropping system were they within? And for this part of the world in the Pacific Northwest, in predominantly dryland cropping area, we went out and said, okay, we're going to define some agroecological classes just based on the percentage of fowl. So if it's 10% or less, fallow, we're going to call it annual cropping. If it's from 10 to 40% fallow, we're going to call it annual crop fallow transition. And if it's greater than 40% fallow, we're going to call it grain fallow. And we can go through this classification procedure just looking at a particular, for each pixel, looking at the pixels around it, and basically classify the pixel in terms of what cropping, what AEC it actually belongs to. And from that standpoint, then we can accumulate, do this every year in terms of the classification and start to look at the dynamic in terms of how different AECs might actually change and how dynamic they are through time. So here's what a map of that looks like from the standpoint of the Pacific Northwest. The blue is irrigated, but the dryland cropping systems, which I'm going to emphasize, are the brown, the really darker brown is the grain fallow. The yellowish color is this annual crop fallow transition, and then the green is the annual cropping. And we can also identify what we're just calling dynamic agroecological classes, where the classification wasn't the same every year. So if it was stable, we were saying, okay, we got the same classification for that pixel every year. But if that changed in some years, then we called that more of a dynamic agroecological class. And the other thing that we went ahead and did, which is relevant to this presentation, is that we then took a number of bioclimatic variables, about 44, and tried to see how well they could actually classify both the stable and dynamic AECs that we had defined here. And we found out that we could do a pretty good job of that, looking at just the current kinds of weather and weather data that we have. And it's expressed here, you can see on the left, in terms of 4 kilometer pixels. And you can kind of see, again, the annual cropping green, the intermediate, kind of this yellow color, and then the grain fallow is this brown color. And then we took then, and by using about 5 bioclimatic variables, we came up with a fairly good prediction from the standpoint of classification of being able to correctly classify these different AECs. So we took then future climate scenarios, and then we imposed them back on what would be our current technology and our current cropping systems to see, okay, given a future projection of climate, what might that look like if we were to superimpose that upon us today? And what we found was a little bit surprising, because we were thinking that through CO2 fertilization and other kinds of mechanisms, we may get increases in yield. But what this analysis shows that we were actually getting more dynamic classifications, in other words, less stable kinds of AECs, but also more prevalence of fallow. So the prevalence of fallow is extremely disturbing from the standpoint. And, you know, this follows from, okay, we're going to be hotter, drier, basically, particularly in the summertime, and that was some of the bioclimatic variables that came through. This, in terms of this particular and very empirical type of analysis, we're seeing, my gosh, fallow could be increasing. And if it does, this has serious implications from the standpoint of soil, because we won't be accumulating soil organic matter through additions of crop residues and roots, et cetera. And we'll also be more prone to soil erosion. So from those standpoints, this could really bode seriously from the standpoint of what we may see in the future if we don't change our agroecological system. So I'm hoping that these kinds of data can actually help to direct some of the research that we could do now in order to avoid perhaps some of this type of scenario playing out. Building soil resilience, one thing that we've really emphasized in my program and as well as others is developing a soil learning community. And at the center of that, I place soil conservation districts. I see Dennis Fuchs over here as a manager for the Soil Conservation District in Stearns County. And, you know, from that standpoint, I see districts as being very powerful entities from the standpoint of here is the voluntary, non-regulatory kinds of approaches at a county level, the grassroots, if you will, of local people that know their communities, know their resource issues, and my gosh, they can serve a leadership capacity in terms of moving forward and identifying what those issues are and then bring to the table the various kinds of expertise and other kinds of community members that can really start to help build this learning community. And through that process, you know, we can recognize the importance of site and time-specific situations and the uniqueness of place that all agriculture has. We can target soil properties and processes to increase our impact and meet the challenge of future uncertainties. I have a certain sense of urgency from the standpoint of the changes that we're talking about. And, you know, we need to increase our impact. We can't be sitting there trying to spin our wheels over issues that may or may not have much impact from the standpoint of moving forward. So this is a mechanism where we can really interact with producers at the ground level to really identify what kinds of practices and what kinds of programs we can go forward with that are going to have impact. And recognizing that this is all an integrative process and, you know, looking at these things holistically at the same time as we get involved with this soil learning community, there's got to be a certain amount of diagnostics that go on that lead to effective decision making. So in the end, we're impacting how decisions are made and how agriculture moves forward. So this can engage farmers and other landowners to solve problems and to build a producer-driven soil learning community. So here's some uniqueness of place, the Palouse Country. It's a beautiful landscape. It also has some challenges that are unique in terms of agriculture. This is a great steep slope that is being farmed by John Asherman. Tremendous yields are still coming off of this ground, just tremendous yields. And in fact, the joke I tell is that, yeah, producers have the most yield per acre, but they also have the most acres per acre. They farm both sides of the slope. So from that standpoint, this is a unique place with some unique challenges. And looking at targets for this place in terms of building soil resiliency and considering some of the vulnerability that we have with the old steep slopes, et cetera, and the uncertainty, you can easily target, and I think this can be done in many places in the world, issues that you have in terms of targets. Soil organic matter and increasing soil organic matter or maintaining it. The soil erosion issue has to be addressed. We have acidification problems. We have compaction issues, and we have nutrient status supplying power issues. And when we talk about soil erosion, what can we tolerate? David Montgomery kind of hit it right, the nail on the head. You know, an inch of soil takes 700 to 1,500 years to form. It's kind of a non-renewable resource when you think about it. But our T values that we have are much more lenient than that and probably not fitting from the standpoint of our long-term sustainability. And in fact, if you talk about conservation compliance and what you need to do to belong to USDA programs, you don't need to have T, you can be 2T, two times T, and still be in those programs. And this, is, to me, is just unacceptable from the standpoint of erosion. We cannot tolerate these kinds of rates, and we need to do something about it. Organic matter depletion, this is a 78 report from the Palouse. 100% of the topsoil removed from 10% of the cropland, 25 to 75% loss from 60% of the cropland. And then later on, other studies, soil organic matter reduced 50 to 70% as compared to native prairie. And if we look at some of the scenarios projecting ahead in terms of climate change, these are data that were collected from long-term experiments that occurred in Morrow, Oregon, a very dry location, Pendleton, Oregon, an intermediate zone that's about 17 inches for precip, Cambridge Farm, which is right near Moscow, Idaho, that's around 25-inch annual precipitation, and the conservation farm, which is in Pullman, which is about 23 or so inches of precipitation. And we looked at studies there, looked at soil organic matter. Here it's expressed in grams per kilogram of soil. But we also related it to mean annual temperature divided by mean annual precipitation, a simple metric of climate. And what we found is climate is a huge driver. There's just no sense or way around it. We see this linear relationship occurring between all these sites across all these different locations with different precipitation levels, and it's negatively related. Sorry. SOC is negatively related to increases in mean annual temperature, and that's what we're predicting, increases in mean annual temperature divided by precipitation, which is expected to remain more constant. And also, you can see the scatter of points around this line. That's the different management scenarios that we have. Management in terms of intensity of cropping systems, reduced tillage, was not nearly as important as climate in influencing how much soil organic carbon we had. And the little clear triangles and circles, those are projections of going down in terms of 2030 and 2070 of organic carbon as we have these future projections in increasing temperatures for our region. So from this standpoint, again, we really need to be considering how are we going to combat this type of situation from the standpoint of a warming climate. One of the efforts that I'm involved with is the Long-Term Agri System Research Network. This is a USDA network that was set up in 2011 and has recently been funded. We have one of these sites at the Cook Agronomy Farm. It's in Pullman, and it's intent is to look at direct seed and precision farming systems and develop principles and strategies that reduce risk and increase profits and improve environmental quality. And from that standpoint, it's long-term efforts like this that I'm hoping will really help to quantify some of the ecosystem services we may or may not derive and some of the trade-offs as we move forward. The first thing we did at the Cook Farm back in 1998 was we sampled the heck out of it. So here's 369 georeference locations scattered across a 37-hectare field, and we went down layer by layer down to 1.5 meters, and we tried to characterize everything that we could. And this gave us a baseline from a situation where we were in a conventional tillage system, and then we converted it all to direct seed or no-till. Some of the consequences of that and some things that we can measure after the course of, this is after 10 years, was, well, how has soil nitrogen changed across this location? And you can see, first of all, that there's tremendous variation across the field itself. Remember, this is only 37 hectares or 92 acres, and we're going from about 4.5 up to 8, almost a doubling in terms of surface of soil nitrogen in terms of megagrams per hectare. And 10 years later, you can see that these scales are all the same in both of these maps, but you can see there's a lot more of this whitish-looking area and some more darker-looking areas where soil nitrogen has increased. It's increased tremendously across this whole field. And in fact, we're increasing by about 30 kilograms of nitrogen per year. So from that standpoint, this represents our building of soil organic matter. Organic matter, of course, has nitrogen within it. We're building up a reservoir of nitrogen within these soils that hopefully can help these situations or these soils be more resilient to differences in precipitation patterns that we may get in the spring, et cetera, to rely more than mineralization processes in terms of nitrogen that might then contribute to the nutrition of our crops. Another thing that we're doing at the Cook Farm is trying to measure site-specific performance. And many of you are familiar with yield maps and these kinds of things that show how those crops performed in terms of yield across landscapes. But more importantly is that we start to build a suite of these kinds of assessments so that we can go in and see, well, it's not just yield, it's how was the water use in terms of its efficiency? How was the nutrient use in terms of efficiency? How about other ecosystem services that we can actually start to assess in a site-specific manner in order to see some of the trade-offs and also to understand if we change soil properties, how in turn is that reflected back in terms of the performance of the system? And this example just shows hard red springweed in terms of nitrogen in the grain divided by nitrogen fertilizer. And you can see there's, again, tremendous variation in nitrogen inputs and outputs for this particular year, a tremendous range of differences. This was uniformly applied nitrogen across this field, but the response of the crop was anything but uniform. And you can see areas that have, since I know this area fairly well, I could see areas like this dark-colored area. These are tremendous soils that are here. These are pluvial loams. They're deep. The roots, they're unrestricted from the standpoints of the roots going down into the soil and being able to take up water and nutrients. And my gosh, this measure of nitrogen balance index is almost through the roof compared to just over the ridge and onto a south slope that has an argillic horizon beneath it and a very different regime from the standpoint of its performance. I'm going to talk about soil acidification just briefly. It's suffice to say that since we started adding synthetic nitrogen fertilizers back in the 60s, we've gone through an acidification process. It's impacted pH, base saturation, also extractable aluminum. They're all, the pH is going down, the extractable aluminum is going up. We're starting to get really, really concerned, and some of this is impacting our performance. Oops. And Bob Mahler did some of the early work back in the 80s, recognized that this is going to be a problem, and you could see basically thresholds of when we start to impact yield from the standpoint of declining pH. And here you can see the legumes are impacted first, and then followed by the cereals a little bit later. But by the time we get down to 5, which many of our soils are starting to approach, then some of these yields are at 50%. Restoring that will take some, perhaps some amendments in terms of liming, but we really had no liming tests, buffer tests, et cetera, that were calibrated or correlated for our particular situation. And so you could take a soil sample to a soil testing lab. They would give you an SMP buffer test or an A&E buffer test and give you a recommendation, but those tests were really not very well calibrated for our area. So we had to go through, again, reflecting the site-specific nature and regional nature of some of our soils and determine what would be appropriate tests from the standpoint of trying to come up with a lime recommendation. With some of Carol McFarland's work, we found a good correlation with the Woodruff 7 buffer test, and now we're moving forward with that to see if we can't use that test and look at field situations. But this is only the beginning of a process. We put a tool into a toolbox for growers to look at and see, okay, it's going to take so many tons of lime to correct my certain situation, but now it costs $70 per ton per acre to apply lime in our neck of the woods. And so from that standpoint, now they have another very economic choice of whether to go forward with this type of process or to start thinking about ways that, one, I might reduce the amount of nitrogen I'm applying to slow this process, or I might change some of my rotation options in order to try to also slow some of this kind of process. And so from that standpoint, I'm going to end up with a project that's being driven by Tabitha Brown and Kendall Call on looking at soil health at the district level and looking at soil testing. And I used and inserted that liming process in terms of determining tests, et cetera, that could lead to decisions on purpose, because I think that's really a bridge that we need to make when we're looking at different kinds of soil tests that we're talking about right now that try to encompass the biological and physical aspects of our soil as well as our chemical aspects. We need to make a strong link between those tests and how growers can make decisions. So from that standpoint, we're going through a process of going in, of looking at a range of soil health indicator values and tests, and then trying to link those tests with current decision-making tools. So thank you.